17 seconds in counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2. All engines running.
Today's guest on Cosmic Perspective was a chemist on the Manhattan Project, a Vedantin monk for 23 years. He's the inventor of the Dobsonian Telescope Mount, is known to many as the Pied Piper of astronomy and the MacGyver of telescope making, John Dobson. John, welcome and thank you for being with us today.
Well, good morning. Over here, it's still morning.
Yes, it's just afternoon here in the East Coast. You've lived a very interesting life for the last 92 and a half years.
Even I think it was interesting.
Tell us a little bit about your background growing up in China.
My mother's father was the founder of Peking University, and he was president when I was a kid. He passed away in 25. But by that time, I was 10 years old, living in his house. And he was the president of Peking University. And I remember his funeral. The two funerals that I remember was John Kennedy's funeral in 63 and my grandfather's funeral in Peking, down the main street of Peking, and with all these hundreds and hundreds of people following. Anyway, so my grandfather was also advisor to the Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893. He was a very well-known preacher.
That's very interesting. And your father was also a professor at the university?
My father taught zoology in Chinese. The Chinese professor says, you do Chinese better than we do. My mother and all of my brothers were born and raised in Peking, but my dad learned the language after he was grown up, and he wouldn't put up with the way we did it. Anyway, my dad was a stickler for precision. See, my dad was a zoologist. He's a scientist, okay? So we were trained, we knew our physics when we were little tiny kids. And I was always fascinated by Einstein and by gravity. Those two things fascinated me always.
As an adult, what made you decide to become a chemist?
I went to the university originally in 1934. To study biochemistry to keep Einstein alive so that he could figure this thing out. I figured the best chance of figuring out this universe is to keep Einstein alive. So that's why I went to the universe. That's why I studied chemistry. And I never knew that I would inherit the problem. I never knew that one.
Why go from a biochemist that, you know, wants to keep Einstein alive to the Manhattan Project? How did that all happen?
Well, I quit the university after 2.5 years, and Swami Ashokananda sent me back to finish. I think he wanted me trained to put science and religion together. Anyway, so he sent me back. So I didn't graduate until 1943. Well, in 1943, we're in the middle of World War II, okay? And you graduate on Sunday, and on Monday you have only two choices, a rifle or a war work job. There were no other choices unless you're a girl.
So you chose...
So I had a war work job, but my first job was not the Manhattan Project. The boss of that one got killed, And then I reapplied on the Manhattan Project, and they put me on sight unseen. They did put anyone from Rubin's project, where they put them on sight unseen. We had that kind of reputation.
You were with the Manhattan Project for a short time. What made you decide to leave and go into the monastery?
I wanted to join the monastery long before that, in 1940. And then Swami sent me back to the university. I didn't finish till 43. And I already wanted to be in the monastery. So I got out of the Manhattan Project through a double interview with the FBI. The second interviewer asked me, "Do you feel that the best thing you can do for your country at the present time is to join a monastery?" "Yes," I said. "Well," he said, "you might be surprised, but many people feel like that." I had no idea that a whole lot of people had the notion that the best thing they can do for their country is to join a monastery in the middle of World War II.
You probably didn't know anything about the Manhattan Project, correct?
We were not told anything about what it was doing, and everything was under code. Uranium was not called uranium, it was called tubaloy. And Los Alamos was not called Los Alamos. It was called Dog Patch. Everything was under code. We were told that we were working for power for ships. Nobody told us we were working on a bomb. I didn't know that until I was in the monastery and we dropped it in 45. Then I knew immediately what we were doing. But what our particular job was taking the uranium off the targets of the cyclotrons. The physicists have no idea what they've done until we clean up the targets and separate the uranium from all that carbon. So they have no idea what they've done until it goes through our shop.
Now you wind up in the monastery, and that's where you wanted to be?
That's where I wanted to be, yes. And then after a while, Swami assigned the job to two of us, put science and religion together. So that's been my job description for 50 years.
While you were at the monastery, what got you interested in building telescopes and the idea of it?
I wanted to see what the heck the universe looked like. And I knew you can't see it very well naked eye. And so first, I wanted to make a telescope, and I got a little lens and made a stupid little telescope. And then one of my friends in the monastery told me, "You can grind your own glass." I said, "You're nuts." But he showed me that you really can grind your own glass. And we started with a 12-inch porthole that my friend had. We had to take care of this friend when he had jaundice. And so he had this porthole on his kitchen table. We asked him on the phone, "How would you like to have that made into a telescope?" Well, he would love it. So that's how we started. We started with a 12-incher.
A piece of porthole glass from a battleship.
Yeah. See, they're usually 12 and they come in half inches, you know, 24 and a half, 18 and a half, 16 and a half. Because if a ship has a 16-inch hole on the side and you put a 16-inch glass in it, it goes straight out to sea. So you put it 16 and a half inches and it doesn't go through the hole. Anyway, porthole sizes are usually in the half inch like that.
The other resources, other parts, how did you get parts for the other parts of the telescope in a monastery?
Oh, that's easy. The rubber hose comes from the rubber companies on this great big spool, okay? And the center of the spool is a 12-inch cardboard tube, 22 inches long. So we glued those things together, 22 inches times 3 and 22 inches times 4. 66 and 88-inch focal length telescopes we made in the monastery.
Nobody even imagined making telescopes that big at that time.
Those were considered pretty big telescopes in those days. But later on, Brian Rhodes and I made a 24-incher. That sleeps 3 in the tube. And we've hauled that more than 80,000 miles through the national parks and the Indian reservations and the state parks and all over the place we hauled that. It's been up to Canada and down to Mexico. More than 80,000 miles we've hauled it. Anyway, it weighs 600 pounds, but it's too late to tell me it's not portable. We've hauled it more than 80,000 miles. But anyway, that's the best view I ever had through a telescope is through that one. Two professional astronomers told me the same thing. The best view they ever had was through the 24-incher.
That's the telescope you brought to the national parks.
Yes. It's really that 24-incher that made the sidewalk astronomers public.
Why leave the monastery after 23 years and start the...
Oh, that's because of a bunch of misunderstandings that got me asked to leave. That's all a mistake. That was all a mistake, yeah.
It wasn't about telescope building.
Oh, no.
It wasn't about your view of the universe or anything like that.
No, nothing like that. Vedantins are interested in science. Swami Vivekananda said, science and truth is all the religion that exists. Veda means knowledge, and Anta means culmination thereof. Vedanta just means the culmination of knowledge. That's all it means.
You left the monastery. You wound up in San Francisco again.
And we started the Sidewalk Astronomers almost at once. Within 1 year, we had the Sidewalk Astronomers.
And how did that all happen?
That's because this nine-year-old kid had a big telescope, and the San Francisco Amateur Astronomers wouldn't let him join their club until he's 14, and he's only 9 years old. He's got 5 years before I can even join their club. And so his mother called me up, and so I sent another kid over to his house, and they decided we should have a club, and I should be in the club. So that's how the Sidewalk Astronomers started. Yeah. Out of the monastery in 67, the Sidewalk Astronomers started in 68.
Tell us a little bit of what's different about Sidewalk Astronomers other than amateur astronomers.
Well, we, first of all, in the 60s, if you went out with the astronomers, they were taking pictures with their little telescopes. They had them all set up so they tracked things across the sky for photography. And we weren't doing that, so we don't have to do all that complicated machinery. We just push the thing around by hand. And so we can make much bigger telescopes and haul them around like that. So that's what happened. What happened was that the amateur astronomers saw all these great big telescopes running around, and they thought, we could do that if we didn't have to take these stupid pictures. What the Sidewalk Astronomers are is public servants, you see. We're a service arm of the national parks. We became a service arm of the national parks. But in the cities, we do planets and the moon. You can't see galaxies and things from the cities, so those things we do in the national parks. And we have fail-safe sun telescopes. We do sunspots also.
Which you've also designed yourself.
Yeah. We have a fail-safe sun telescope. I wish a lot of amateurs would make that kind of thing. Our fail-safe sun telescope can't possibly be used to hurt your eye unless you set fire to the telescope and hold your eye over it. First, you have to get my permission. Now, you see, when we get our telescope out in Death Valley and so forth, you see, we have to stay by the telescope all day long to see that nobody turns it into the sun. If he turns the telescope into the sun, there are two problems. If he gets his eye on the eyepiece, not only his eye would be blind, his eye would be smoking. That's not the only problem. The telescope will catch fire if it's facing into the sun. Even if the light doesn't get into the eyepiece, it'll catch fire to the telescope. And you're not allowed to burn down the national parks. It's against the law.
Your design of a solar telescope is much safer.
It is the safe way to look at the sun, yeah.
And would you like to explain it a little bit to us, your design?
We have a transparent mirror on the front that throws 95% of the light away, lets 5% come in, and it's at 45 degrees on the front. It's not flat across. It's at 45 degrees on the front. So it throws 95% of the light away, lets 5% in. The mirror at the bottom is unsilvered. It sends back only 4% of that 5%. That's reflected from the backside of the front plate through a welder's glass into the eyepiece.
So very minimal by the time it reaches your eye.
That uses maybe 10 millionths of the incoming light, yeah. It's totally safe.
What gave you the idea of the Dobsonian telescope mount?
Well, that's the easiest way to aim above the horizon. It's the same way that the cannons go. The Oakland amateur astronomers, they were going to give me an award for public service in astronomy. So they referred to the Dobsonian Revolution, the Dobsonian Revolution. I got up and said all the previous revolutions were run with cannons on Dobsonian mounts. They go up and down the way we go, and they go round and round the way we go. The problem, if you want to aim at the sky, you got to go round and round, you got to go up and down. There's nothing else you have to do.
Most of our listeners may not have a telescope or have seen a Dobsonian telescope up front, up live. but they're very large apertures. Some people have, I've looked through a telescope with a 36-inch mirror. They call it the yard scope.
Yes, I've looked through the yard scope. I got to tell you a funny story on that one. Summerfield was collecting money to buy that, you see, from Tom Clark, who made it in Florida. Anyway, so this was at Riverside. He was collecting money to buy it, and I gave him a $20 bill. Next time he saw me, about a year later, he says, after you gave me that $20 bill, people stood in line to give me money.
You use the telescope to, that's your window to the universe, basically. And has this helped you bridge or connect science and faith together?
Oh, I didn't have that kind of a problem. We Vedantins are scientists, you see. And Swami Vivekananda, who started the order, you see, he wanted monks to go from village to village with projectors, you see, to educate the villagers in science. He wanted it done anyway. So we started out as a service arm of the Vedanta centers, and we became a service arm of the national parks. Very few people know where they live. They think they're born in some stupid town. No, they're born on an Earth in a solar system in a galaxy. And that's part of your address.
That brings up a very interesting subject. The most popular theory today of how the universe was formed is the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
But I understand that you have a universe model of your own.
Yes, recently, because I don't approve of the Big Bang, they scheduled for me a debate with somebody in England. He's going to push the Big Bang, and I'm going to push against it, okay? So, since I'm not in favor of the Big Bang, I told the other debater that, as I see it, the Big Bang takes non-existence for granted and gets the universe out of nothing. I said, what I see as my model takes existence for granted, but not space and time. Recycling model. I have the negative entropy recycling from the border. First, you have to get to hydrogen. That's real easy. The electron is wound up against smallness, and the proton is wound up against gravity, against dispersion, you see. And that makes hydrogen. And the hydrogen falls together by gravity and into stars, and they shine. Now, the shining drives the expansion, cosmological expansion. The cosmological expansion imposes a boundary to the observable universe, because somewhere out there, the stuff is going away as fast as the speed of the light. So when we look out there at the border, where things are going away at that high speed, and everything is redshifted, then the particles are very lightweight out there, as seen by us. Now, if the particles have very low mass, as seen by us, they have to recycle from the border. Because if their mass is low, their momentum is low. If their momentum is low, our uncertainty in that momentum is low. If our uncertainty in the momentum is low, our uncertainty in where they are has to be infinite, because that's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You can't know both where something is and what it's doing. If you know what it's doing, that is, if the momentum goes down, then you cannot know where it's doing it. And so the particles have to recycle from the border. That's my recycling model. There were some physicists in India a long time back, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years back. I don't know how many thousand years back. And they built their physics into their language. And in the Sanskrit language, the universe is said to be made of energy. The whole universe is said to be made of energy. And even if you divvy it up into matter and energy, it's still only energy. Now, Swami Vivekananda translated that Sanskrit to Nikola Tesla in 1896, and Tesla fed the information to his close friend, Mileva Merrick, who became Einstein's first wife. She's responsible for E equals mc squared. That's translated straight out of Sanskrit, and it's very old.
Einstein's wife was jointly responsible for the equation?
I think so. And the relativity paper is by both of them, by him and her. The other papers, his quantum mechanics paper, that's his paper. and his Brownian motion paper, that's his paper. But the relativity paper is our paper. It says that what we call matter is just energy. That's all it says. There's only one thing here. The whole universe is made out of energy, not out of anything else. Now, let me give you the observational evidence that the universe is really recycling from the border, okay? Because if it recycles from the border, it recycles as hydrogen. Now, the Hubble telescope reports that there's more than enough hydrogen in those intergalactic voids to make all the known galaxies. Now, the Big Bang people have no way to put hydrogen back into the universe. My model keeps the universe wound up with fresh hydrogen. The Big Bang does no such thing.
The term Big Bang was a mockery of the theory,
yes,
correct?
Hoyle made fun of it, but they've settled for that name anyway. The Big Bang was originally started because of the negative entropy problem. They knew that the entropy, the scrambledness of the energy, is going up. So the universe could not have been going on like this forever. It would have been long gone. So they had to have a beginning. So they assigned a beginning, and they didn't notice what I noticed, that the radiation is going to drive the expansion. So they invented an explosion. That's how the Big Bang arose. First, it has to have a beginning because the scrambledness of the energy is going up, and they have no source of unscrambling it.
What about dark matter?
The door that's right in front of me is dark matter. If it doesn't shine by itself, it's dark matter.
From what I understand,
the universe is hydrogen, and it's all dark. It doesn't shine by itself.
From what I understand, Vera Rubin's, her findings, were the responsibility for the Big Bang theory to adopt dark matter into their theory. Is that correct?
Well, she is the one who noticed that the speed of the stars around the central bulge is at the same speed as it is around the edge of the galaxy. And it really is that way. You see, when the stars form in the central bulge, their stellar winds blow the rest of the gas out of there. There's not a whole lot of stuff in the middle of the central bulge.
Anyway,
they couldn't believe that the stars really go around the central bulge at the same speed that they go around the outside edge.
Her observational data spoke for itself.
She's on the observational data, and they were on guesswork.
You've made some incredible contributions to astronomy. The average person can now build an inexpensive large aperture telescope to view the universe. You've given the public an alternate model of the modern-day universe model, as Galileo did in his day. Fortunately, you're not under house arrest at this time.
No, I'm not under house arrest.
My question to you is, after almost 90 years of dedicating your life to understanding the universe, what are your feelings on what you've accomplished, and where do we go from here?
Stick to the observations, not to the guesswork. There's too much guesswork in the religious views, and there's too much guesswork in the Big Bang view, in my opinion. But you've got to take Einstein's equations the way they're written. Einstein's geometry takes space and time out of the cosmology. You don't have to make the universe out of space and time. The total goes to zero, the same as the total momentum goes to zero. Anyway, and E equals mc squared. It does not mean that matter can be converted to energy. It means that there's only one thing here, energy.
So energy equals matter, matter is energy.
What we see as matter is just a form of energy, yes.
Thanks very much for joining us, and I wish you many, many more hours of observational data, learning about the universe.
Information needs to get out to the public. The public needs to know where the hell they're born.
Thank you very much for your point of view and your contributions to astronomy.
Okay. Bye-bye.